Very good.
A nice dinner? Oh, I'm jealous. Anybody there? No one there? No talking. So we'll teach the meditation, the sound of silence. Hello? Still nobody there. Please. This is going to be a very peaceful evening. No questions, no answers. Anybody there yet? Come in, ground control, it's on. Nothing there. Nobody home. The tsunami ghost has got into the system. It's got to happen. No, nothing's happening. This never happened to Madonna or Justin Bieber. Anybody there? No. Hello. Here we go. The management are here to pick it up. So, well, how many people can you get in that room to pick it up? Hello. No, nothing's happening. It is. Not very loud. That's better. It's growing stronger and stronger. Is that good enough? Hello? Can you all hear?
Yes.
Very good. So, now we get to the basket case questions. See which is going to be the first question. Drawing out the lucky hat. The winner of the first question is, dear Ajahn, when I meditate on a chair, I fall asleep. Should I sit on a chair or should I sit on the floor? Thank you. One of the things we used to do as monks to stop us falling asleep, we'd sit like on the edge of a precipice. So you sit right on the very edge of this precipice here. So if you fall off, you're going to get very, very bruised. Which means you will not be able to fall off at all. Or you can go up on top of the roof and sit on the ledge. They seem to say this. There was this monastery in Laos when I was a young monk. And it was very famous. This was just before the Vietnam War. And the teacher would take his young monks on a walk through the forest, through the jungle, all day. And when it got to about 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, he would always manage to find his way to this clearing where these really tall trees were. And in these trees, the monks before had built little platforms, just, you know, this size, the size of this little mat here, that's what it was, with no railings, and bamboo ladder. And he told the monks to climb up and sit meditation on this very small platform, so high up in the canopy of the forest. And then the abbot would take the ladders away and say, I'll be back in the morning. And there all these tired monks would have to sit on a small platform with no railing all night. And if they went to sleep, that would be the last sleep of their life. They'd wake up dead. And because there was such a big drop, and because they were afraid of falling off, many monks said they got great meditation up there, high in the forest, on these little platforms. At least the monks who survived said that. The ones who died never said anything. So now that's one way of dealing with it, but it's not a very good way. So look, if sitting on a chair makes you fall asleep, then that means you're tired. So change your meditation place. Don't meditate on the chair. Meditate on the bed, like flat out. And if you're going to go to sleep in the proper place, because you're tired. So it's wonderful if you just take a good sleep, and then afterwards you come and sit on the chair, sit on the floor, you don't fall asleep at all. So if you always fall asleep when you're sitting on a chair, don't lean back, lean forward on the chair. Keep a straight back, then you don't tend to fall asleep. If that doesn't work, you can get another type of chair, an electric chair if you want. So I meditate on that. Anyway, that's enough of that. Actually, there's a story about that. I heard this actually from one of the ex-governors of Australia. He gave a lecture and he said, he's given a lecture on spin by politicians. And he said there was a prominent family some years ago in the United States, and they wanted to get their family history written in a book. So they hired a very, very good author. You know, paid him a lot of money. Can you please research and tell us about our family history so we can write a book about it? So they said that there was one big problem, that one of their relations, a long time ago, was a bit of a gangster and was caught by the police and was executed in the electric chair. And they said, you know, you've got to tell the truth, but you know, just sort of sanitize that part of our family's history so it doesn't look so bad. So this author, he wrote that this certain member of the family, he entered a very prestigious and well-known government institution where he was given a chair at this institution, and his death came as a shock. And that's what they wrote in the family history. Given a chair at a famous institution, Sing Sing I think it was, and his death came as a shock. Anyway, how do I overcome restlessness in meditation? My mind runs and runs and stops for a few minutes of mindfulness and it's off again. If I let it be, my mind runs even faster. If I make peace with it, it never stops. But of course, forcing my mind to keep still also doesn't work. And so I hardly get any mindful breath at all. What should I do? Often I get insomnia because the restlessness, help! So, this is a common problem. One of the reasons you get a few moments of mindfulness when you're not thinking, and why do you go thinking again? So always try and find out cause and effect. One of the problems is, it's because we're afraid of peace. We're not used to it. It takes a while for us to get used to peace and to know it's very safe, so we don't need to disturb it. Where I live in Australia, it's very, very quiet. And I noticed something strange. When visitors would come for the first time, it was so quiet that they raised their voice and started shouting instead of normal speech. And I realized it was a psychological response. It was so quiet they were afraid they needed to destroy it to make it noisy, so they were back in their comfort zone, like the normal city sounds. Sometimes we're not used to silence. And because of that, we disturb it. Which is why when you are silent, no need to be afraid. It's very beautiful and very peaceful, and it's very healthy for you. So when it does come, please respect it. Unfortunately, we live in a modern age where it's very hard to find silence. You go into shopping centres and there's music all the time. Even in this hotel, I walk here through the corridors and there's this music being played all the time. It's so hard to find silence. We got so unused to silence, we're afraid of it. I remember once, I was 19 years of age, and I was walking back from a pub with my girlfriend. I was. And it was perfectly dark. I noticed it was the first time in my life I'd experienced 100% darkness and couldn't see at all. Because growing up in London, there was always some light from somewhere. First time, have you ever experienced darkness? In real darkness, there's no light at all. You can't see lights in the distance, there's no light in the where you are. Total darkness. And that was really weird. It helped a lot, you were with your girlfriend at the time. But it was a really strange experience. It's like silence. Have you ever experienced real silence before? We live in an artificial world where we don't know darkness. But we don't know silence. It's unnatural. But after a while, in meditation, you get experience of the silence. And you get used to it, which means you don't destroy it. It means you don't have to be restless. So when the silence comes, don't disturb it. And it stays a long time. A lot of times we destroy it because we're afraid. That's my part of my job, to convince you the joys, the peace, the happiness, the great benefits of silence. So when you go and be restless, what's another reason for restlessness? Again, part of being afraid is we're not content, we're not happy, we're not at ease with the silence. So which is why I've told a number of people in the interviews, develop some content. Just being happy to be here, wherever that happens to be. If you're sleepy, be content. If you're restless, be content with your restlessness. Because by having many, many moments of contentment, one after another, after another, you'll find the thinking stops. The sleepiness disappears. Because all you can do is to create the causes for peace in the future. That's your job. Create the causes. Contentment, letting things be, making peace, being kind, being gentle, is creating the causes for the stopping of restlessness. But if you fight restlessness, if you have ill will towards restlessness, if you don't want restlessness, you create the causes for more restlessness. That is how it works. So like when you try to go to sleep at night. And there was a couple of years ago, I don't know what it was, maybe I was drinking too much tea or coffee or whatever, I find it difficult to go to sleep at night, get a good night's sleep. And I'm a very busy, I've got to do many, many things, and sometimes I would think, wow, if I don't get a good sleep this morning, I've got to teach tomorrow morning, I'll give a bad talk because I'm too tired. And so I really tried hard to go to sleep. And of course, the harder you try, the more impossible it gets. So I decided to use another method. I decided, and this was very true, my bed, even though it's only a mattress in my cave at Serpentine, is the most comfortable place in the whole monastery. Isn't your bed comfortable? Much more comfortable than sitting here. You can lie out and stretch, and it's really cozy and comfortable. In fact, it's such a pleasant experience lying in bed. That's why when you wake up in the morning, you don't want to get out. Isn't that very comfortable when you first wake up? You're lying there nice and cozy and comfortable. What do I want to get out for? And I realized that being in bed is one of the most comfortable places to be. So I decided I don't want to waste this comfortable feeling by going to sleep. So I'm going to lay in here all night, perfectly awake, totally enjoy the cozy, comfortable, warm feeling of just lying flat out in bed. As soon as I stopped trying to go to sleep, and instead started trying to be awake, I fell asleep straight away. It's very common in my meditation retreats. When people try and be mindful and meditate, they fall asleep. When they go to bed at night and try and fall asleep, they keep awake. Well, what happened? Because you're trying. So instead, when you go to bed at night, use reverse psychology, try to stay awake. If you try to stay awake, you've got to sleep very quickly. This is the difficulty, this is the difference. Just be content to be laying here, perfectly comfortable in your nice, warm, cozy bed, and then you finally go to sleep. If you try to go to sleep, it doesn't work. If you try to stay awake, then you go to sleep. Many people actually tell me, the other way of going to sleep, many people say that they listen to my talks on CDs that send them to sleep. I still don't know whether that's a compliment or whether that's a sign to talk to boys. Many people do that. They listen to a talk as they go to bed at night and you fall fast asleep. I don't mind. Then Ajahn, I felt a hot sensation of heat when I was doing walking meditation. Then I felt a sense of lightness and good too. Can you guide me further with metta? You must be, if it was a girl, you must be hot chick. If you're a guy, you must be hot guy. Hot dude. Because then I felt heat sensation when you were walking. No, if you feel heat sensation when you're walking, a lot of times it's the same as when you've driven your car and you park it. It's hot. The engine has been running. You've got the excess heat, which has to dissipate before your engine cools down. When you are meditating, walking or sitting meditation, because you've been doing a lot, your metabolism is high. As soon as you start to stop, let go, be peaceful, then metabolism hasn't adjusted yet. It takes a few minutes until you get some heat coming up in your body. So if it's heat, which is at the beginning of the meditation, it's just your body adjusting to the slower pace which you've now gone into. You've gone down the gears. If it's in the middle of the meditation, especially when you're getting peaceful, that is a very good sign. Because that heat in the middle of the meditation, or when you're getting very peaceful, is a great sign of healing. Many people have had this great heat, especially heat spots in one part of your body, in your shoulders, or you women, in your breasts, or in some other area of your body. And it suddenly just gets really hot in there, and afterwards you feel so relaxed and so peaceful. That is healing going on. Many times that's happened. One of the first cases, and the case I usually describe, this one woman came to see me. This was in Perth many, many years ago. She was meditating and her whole shoulders and neck got really hot, like it was a fever. Nowhere else in her body, just there. And she said, "What's going on? It was really weird." And then I said to her, "When did you have your car accident, the whiplash?" And that's when she raised her hand. "I don't know, how did you know? I haven't told anybody about that. It's true, you can read my mind, you've got psychic power, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu." I said, "No. It's just, I've been doing this a long time, this is just logic. Without heat, I know it must mean that you have some injury there. And when you're meditating, the energy of the body, now felt as heat, has gone there to heal your injury." He said, "You probably feel just more relaxed in that area than you've ever been for weeks. Or since your injury." She said, "Yeah, it feels so good then." And because the neck and shoulder injuries, the most common form cause of that injury is these car accidents when you get whiplash. I just added one and one together to make two. That was all. I wasn't reading anybody's minds. And this is actually what happens. You get these hot spots. I say in the breast, because many women get that, because many of you are subject to breast cancers. And there you are meditating, and something gets very hot in there. You don't have to worry. What would have been a breast cancer has now been stopped. Well done. You've avoided one of the terrible experiences which women have to face. When you get these hot spots, brilliant, don't interfere. That is the body healing itself. But that's in the middle of the meditation, or towards the end you're getting peaceful. That's brilliant. Carry on. You're doing amazing things for your own body. But the main thing here, you said you're doing walking meditation, you felt a sense of lightness and very good too. Brilliant. That's what meditation is supposed to make you feel really good and light. And if the heat comes, there must be some little bit of healing going on. So well done. Very good meditation. After death questions. When we do these after death questions, we should actually turn down the light to make it more spooky. I can tell people this now. If I don't, it's funny because, you know, it's funny because you've got a couple of days to go, but this in the main island in Phuket. There's apparently a true story after the tsunami. A couple of days afterwards, one of the taxi drivers picked up a couple of Westerners, I think three of them, and they wanted to go to the beach, one of the beaches which were badly affected by the tsunami. So the Thai taxi driver, you know, opened the doors and let them inside, and he was just concentrating on the road, and when he turned around, he saw there's no one in his cab. He picked up three ghosts. After which, he gave up his taxi driving job and did something else. So be careful, taxi drivers here, you don't know who's in the cab sitting next to you. Well, anyway, that's many years ago, all the ghosts are gone. In Buddhism, when people die, the Buddha said, soul of good people goes to heaven, soul of bad people go to hell. When Buddha and Arahant monks died, Paramanibbana, where did they go? I know only they never got reborn again. They go to the place of nowhere, of emptiness. They vanish, disappearing, poof, gone without a trace. No one knows where they've gone, because no one knows where they came from. They came without trace, like birds flying through the sky, leave no vapor trail. The great monks and nuns and enlightened beings, they go, and not even the FBI can find out where they're gone.
They have disappeared, vanished, gone forever. The great disappearing act is not even Houdini could emulate the ability of the escape artists called the enlightened monks and nuns, escaping from samsara. Where did they go? Where did they go? They went nowhere. They vanished. Poof. Disappeared. That is awesome.
That's what happened. They're gone.
How can they just disappear like that?
Because they realized there was nothing there to begin with. What was nothing has now got back to nothing. Isn't that amazing? That's why you should call Marx your emptiness, or even better, your nothingness. Yes, you're going to tell me some sweet nothings? Go.
How did a first person come on earth? There can never have been a first person. Because where did that person come from? If it was a person, they must have had a mummy and daddy. So they couldn't have been the first. Have you got a mummy and daddy? Everybody's got a mummy and daddy. So the first person had to have a mummy and daddy, so they couldn't have been the first. But if you change our idea and think, why should there have been a first anyway? Why can't we have this infinite sequence? In other words, there's always been some form of life. And there always will be some form of life. No beginnings, no ends. Just like in physics, in the astrophysics of the galaxy, this universe in which we live, you go outside and see the night sky, you only see a fraction of what's out there. It's roughly about 14,000 million light years in diameter. Scientists can pretty well know the volume of this universe, in which space and all the atoms and planets and solar systems and galaxies and clusters of galaxies all in it. It's a finite volume, but there's no edge to it. There's no wall like I see in Singapore with these pictures of a guy with a gun saying you can't go further than this. This universe has no edges. There's not infinite inside. How can that be? Just like the simile of the ant crawling over the soccer ball, goes round and round and round and round, can never find an edge, an end to the universe of a soccer ball. There's only a certain area of that soccer ball, and there's never any barrier or edge, no beginning, no end. That's the two-dimensional simile. If you expand that to three dimensions, you get the measure of our universe. This universe, which literally bends in on itself like a soccer ball does, has a finite volume with no edges. Have you ever thought in the quiet times of your life, how can we have a universe? Do you go so far then you fall off the edge? Is there a big wall which says end of universe, don't go further, prohibited? It's not like that. There's no edges. It's a finite volume. Now, as even Stephen Hawking's positive in the brief history of time, why can't the same be true of time? Time, with no edges to it, goes round and round and round. That is the only explanation which is logical. Not even the infinite, finite period of time, but with no edges to it. No beginning and no end. Just like life itself. Even time reincarnates. Get your head around that, and then you just notice how you expand your imagination to answer these questions. The question is, there never was a first person. There can't be. That's illogical.
people have just been always here and always will be here. That is the nature of our universe, limited but without ages. That's awesome. I love getting people's heads really screwed up. But you know, that is true. That's Stephen Hawking, the great physicist. That's how he sees it. Okay, that's what happens to you. Round and round and round. That's the whole idea of, you know, people who think this is our only life. That's crazy. We just can't come from nowhere, and here we are, we get born. Any mother who's had a child knows that child comes out of your womb with history. They're not a black slate. They've got a personality, a character. Very often it's different from mother and father. It cannot be explained by genes. They've come from previous lives. These universes come from previous universes. And time comes from previous time. No beginning, no end. Round and round and round. Like everything else in this universe. That is cool. Anyway, my husband had a very short attention span. Wouldn't have been able to understand that thing. But anyway, I was like, my husband has a very underlined in capital letters short attention span. He can't seem to pay attention to a dumber for more than a few minutes, even your delightful talk, Thatcher, please help. I'm sure he's got a lot of attention span to soccer or to a movie or mahjong or whatever else he likes. If you like it, you've got a lot of attention span. That's why when I give these talks, I crack jokes and make funny anecdotes, because that keeps people's attention. If I didn't tell funny stories, people will fall asleep. That's why I tell funny stories or outrageous sayings, simply to keep people awake and keep their attention. They've got a thing these days called info entertainment. This is dumber info entertainment. We enjoy it, but it's also a good vehicle to present the dumber as well. That's why you all know what type of a tradition do I belong to? Hahayana, yes. It's a combination of Hinayana, Mahayana and Vajrayana. The H from Hinayana, the Aha from Mahayana, the Yana from Vajrayana, which is Hahayana. That's my vehicle, the Hahayana. And if you really do very well in the Hahayana, become enlightened, what do you call? The Ha-ha-ha-ha-ha. There you go, now you're laughing and paying attention. That's how to get people's attention span going. So, it's only if it's interesting for people. Or you tell ghost stories, and people love ghost stories because that really gives them, you know, they keep their attention. Was it the last time I gave a retreat? How many were here the last retreat we gave? That was at, Western, that was at Phuket Island. How many of you were here for that? Put your hand up. Well, most of you, but half of you weren't. So I could tell this story again. This is wonderful. I'm going to do it anyway, if everyone put their hands up. Is there any way we could turn the lights down? Because this is one of the scariest ghost stories. This is the coffin ghost. Golden Oldie. So can you tell that? Very good, the lights are going down. So this was the story. And there was this man, he went to the Buddhist temple one evening. He had listened to a wonderful talk, but on the way home he had to walk back from the temple to his house. And unfortunately the only way back was past the cemetery. And I don't know why this is, but when you're walking down the street, this very light, that's much better. It is very bright street lights. But when you get to the cemetery, the street lights are staying further apart than usual. It's dark. So this man, he was walking home and he had to go past the cemetery, and it was very, very dark. And as you walk past these old gravestones, it's the most spooky place you could possibly be. And it was so quiet, so still, except for the sound of his feet. And it seemed to take forever to get even to the halfway mark. And even though he had seen nothing and heard nothing, still his heart was beating boom, 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 as you do when you start to get scared. He was halfway, so he thought now he was safe. When he got to about three quarters of the way, that's when he heard something was following him. He heard the footsteps, what he thought were footsteps behind him. And he wondered where they came from. Wherever it was, they must have come from the graveyard. He didn't want to look around. He was too frightened. Instead, he started walking fast. And as he walked faster, whatever it was that was following him also walked faster. So he started running. And the thing behind him started running. And so he had to look around. And he wished he had never turned around to see. Because what was following him was the most scary thing you'd ever want to see. It wasn't a person. It was a wooden box. It was a coffin covered with cobwebs bumping along the road behind him. Bump, 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 bump. He was being chased by an upright coffin. So he ran as fast as he could. And the coffin, bump, 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 started running after him. And it was catching up on him. The coffin was running much faster. He managed to just get, he was very lucky that his house was close by. He got to the front gate. And he tried to open the front gate. But because he was so afraid, he kept fumbling with the latch. Bump, bump, bump. And the coffin was getting closer. He managed to just get inside the gate and slam the gate too. And the coffin was right at the gate. Bump! Went the coffin. Bump! Breaking through the gate. He got to the door of his house and he tried to get the keys out. And what did he do? He dropped the keys! Bump! As the coffin broke through the gate, it was only about 5 or 6 meters behind him. This was so close. He managed to pick up the keys. He didn't know which was the right key. Any old key would do. He put it in. Oh, he was so lucky it was the right key. He turned the lock, opened the door, took the key out, slammed the door, just as the coffin came, bump! Right onto the front door. He was inside. Bump! Went the coffin again, against the front door of his house. Bump! Even harder. And the latches started to give way. They started to split. It was only a matter of seconds. And that spooky supernatural coffin would break through the door. He did the only thing he could think of. He ran up the stairs into the only room with a lock. The toilet. Bam! Went the coffin. And the door gave way. And there, at the top of the stairs, he looked. There was a coffin coming for him, up the stairs. Bump, bump. He slammed the door of the toilet, the bathroom, and locked the door. Bump, 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 bump! Right against the bathroom door. The coffin was not going to give up. Bump! Even harder.
and the panel of the wood on the door started to splinter. Bam! It was only a matter of a second or more, and that coffin would break through. He had nowhere else to go. His back was against the wall, his arms spread out. Bam! And the coffin broke through.
There's nowhere else to go. As the coffin was coming for him, he did instinctively, he reached for a bottle on the bathroom shelf
and threw it at the coffin.
The coffin stopped. It stopped. Because that was a bottle of cough mixture. It stops the coffin. Okay, we could have the lamp cutter. I could need the question. That went down very well last year as well. So it has to be a tradition to always tell the coffee joke if you make a difference. Anyway. And I'm sure your husband paid full attention to that. My right hand was on top of my left. My two thumbs touched my initial position. After a while, I didn't feel them. Then I saw lights, coloured ones, left side, right side. My question is this initial application? Don't call it initial application. This is the start of limiters. You start to see lights. Because I can still hear outside noise. The grass cutting machine, can you leave me from here? I don't need you from here. You just stop and you get led into the deeper meditation. Stay with those lights, don't do anything. They will center themselves. Sometimes they appear the left and right, just allow them to be, and they soon come into the center, getting brighter and brighter, and they take you into very deep meditation. You don't do anything, maybe you're a passenger. So remember, just let things be. You don't do anything, don't disturb it. Things are happening, just enjoy it. Okay. How do I get rid of my addiction to pornography? Are there any bad karma from watching too many videos of others being hurt and degraded, even though I don't engage in such acts? Of course there is. Because, number one, it really sort of is bad karma to keep watching pornography. And what it means is that gets into your head that when you die, you get reborn in the pornographic hell. And that's really awful. Because what you enjoy seeing others do happens to you. That's not very nice. So that's not a great place to be reborn into. So it's really bad karma. So please just let it go. There's many more things you can enjoy yourself with instead of the low stuff. Because remember, this is like low-grade happiness. If you have low-grade happiness, you become a low-grade person. You know, not even a human being anymore. Almost like an animal, even lower than an animal. So it's really one of those addictions. It's not included in the five precepts because they didn't have pornography in the internet in the time of the Buddha. I'm sure if he was alive to say that would be the sixth precept. Or maybe you can include it under sexual misconduct. There's a bad karma to do. But you know that there was one monk with Ajahn Chah, and he had a lot of trouble with his sexual fantasies. And so he went to see Ajahn Chah one day and said, look, can you help me that when I'm meditating, I have all these fantasies go on in my head. And I want to cure them. Can you please give me some advice, some trick to cure all those fantasies? Yeah, it's very easy to do. Next time there's a public talk, you give that public talk and you tell all the lay people who've been feeding you for so long what you've been thinking about when you're supposed to be meditating. And say, that will cure you. He didn't do that. But look, you should be embarrassed about that, whoever it is. You're thinking, aren't you embarrassed about that? If you're not, you tell me who you are. I'll check out the handwriting. Because you all made applications, and so we can soon check. And I'll tell everybody who it is. Because if you get found out, isn't that embarrassing? So would you really want to tell people what you're up to? Let's stop it. Don't do it for goodness sake. It's bad karma and it's very bad. Dear Ajahn, my dearly beloved mom passed away late last year. I was told we do not send message to departed ones, but I really wish to do so. Is there any problem with that? No, of course there's no problem with that. I send message to all sorts of things. I was telling people today, and I still send message to machines as well. Because I remember I told a story, when I started building a monastery over in Australia, we had a cement machine, and I really cared for that cement machine, the cement mixer. So much so that I used to give it lots of metta, and it would, this is absolutely true, it would work for me, it wouldn't work for other monks. They tried to pull it to get it started, they couldn't do it, so leave it alone, it's mine, I've stroked it, and said, look, it's okay, now I'm here now, and I pulled the string and it works every time, first time. Yeah, it's absolutely true, it does that. You try that with your car or with your computer, if it doesn't work, just give it some loving kindness. This is another story which I love telling. This was that German guy, he was with me in Bodhidharma Monastery for about 6 months, when he was at university, I think in Hamburg, the first day on campus, when he walked past the ATM machine, he swears that ATM made a sound at him. He said it was like a gurgling sound. And he took that as the ATM was welcoming him onto campus. So he was a Buddhist, and so he gave loving kindness back to his favourite ATM machine. And that's the one he'd always use, and always speak to the ATM machine, give it loving kindness. And what happened one day, he said, absolutely true story, he said, I'm not making this up, there's no reason to make it up. He was having his lunch on a bench, really close by to the ATM machine. No one had been close to the ATM machine for about at least 20 minutes since he started his lunch. And he heard the gurgle again, the same sound as when he first went onto campus. So he turned around and looked at the ATM machine, and out came a 20 euro note. And no one had been close to it. So he went up to that machine, took out the 20 euro note, and weighed it in the air. Does this belong to anybody? Does this belong to anybody? No one claimed it. And he realized that that's what happens when you give loving kindness metta to an ATM machine. It repays your kindness, you know, with $20 or whatever the currency happens to be. So if you are really short of cash, I walk past the ATM machine so many times, please say, have a lovely evening, ATM machine. Give it a try. Are you sure you're okay? You know, be kind to it, and who knows, one day you you may get a 100 baht note out of the ATM machine. He swears that's absolutely true. Kindness actually works, the machine. So certainly it can send out your kindness to a human being, even though they passed away. So please do that. It's lovely thing to do. Meditator and schizophrenic. I have two persons inside, speak to themselves, see weird things, hear weird things. So is the meditator a schizo? Is a schizo a meditator? It really depends on exactly what you're talking about. I have the two persons inside. Sometimes people look at their mind like that, you know, the good person and the bad person, and you have a conversation. Should I do this? Should I do this? No, 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 don't do it, don't do it. No, but I must do it. No, no, don't do it. That's just a way of just resolving problems with inside yourself. That's not two persons inside of you. So a lot of time it's not two persons at all. It's just the two halves of your personality. And you speak to themselves, yeah, you see weird things. It's nice to see weird things or hear weird things. So in other words, don't be concerned about that at all. As long as you are relating to yourself and to the world in an appropriate way. In other words, those things which you hear you don't take too seriously, there is no problem at all. So I've never had experience with schizophrenia personally. There's only one in me and that's more than enough inside of your graph. But one of our monks is a clinical schizophrenic, at least that's what he's called, doing amazing stuff as a monk. And he just accepts himself as he is at peace with himself, and meditates, has a wonderful time. He just doesn't pay any attention to those inner voices. He just hears them, but they're not important. And he's an amazing case. He's one of the people, the first person who was a diagnosed schizophrenic, who's a monk, a great meditator, and he's doing wonderfully well. So it really depends on who you actually are. But also, I should say, there is no such thing as a schizophrenic. It's people who have episodes of schizophrenia. And so don't just call a person a schizophrenic, or dyslexic, or an idiot, or sort of a restless, or a bad meditator. You're not anything. You're just a person who sometimes has bad meditations. You're not someone who is depressed. You're a person who has depressive episodes every now and again. So don't label yourself. As soon as you label yourself, you're stuck with that label and you actually live up to it. Which is why the head of the schizophrenic unit in the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore told me he doesn't treat schizophrenia anymore. This is the head doctor in the hospital in Singapore. He says, I treat the other half part of the patient. Not the schizophrenic part, the other part. It's an amazing result. I really respect that doctor. He understood. Next question. Can Ajahn Brahm explain Nibbana to me? No, I can't. Next question. Of course you can explain Nibbana. And the classic way of describing Nibbana is the old story of the wishing game and the five children. Five children were playing the wishing game. And the rules of the wishing game are this. Everyone has one wish. Whoever comes up with the best wish wins the game. So the first boy, he said, if I had a wish, I would wish for the latest Nintendo. The new one coming out. So I can play computer games. Very good. The next kid, never be the first to answer, because once you've heard somebody else's, you can always improve on it. So the second kid said, if I had a wish, I would have my own computer game shop. Then I can't just have one computer game or one Nintendo. I can have an Xbox. I can have whatever I want whenever I need it. So I got my own store. So obviously that's a superior wish. The third kid was far brighter. He said, if I had a wish, let's go for broke, I will have $100 billion US. But with $100 billion US, first of all, I'll buy my own computer shop. So I can have all these computer games whenever I want them. But the trouble is, he said, my mummy will not let me play computer games all day. She says I have to go to school. So then, after I bought my own computer shop, the next thing I'll do, I'll buy my own school. But when I own the school, I don't need to go there, and I can still give myself top marks, because I employ all the teachers. If they don't give me top marks, they get fired. And once I graduate from my own school, then I'll buy my own university. You can do that these days. And again, I'll give myself honorary degrees. And that way, I don't need to study anymore. I can spend all day doing computer games. And also, he said, that when I think of something else I need, with $100 billion US, you can't spend that in your whole lifetime. So I always have enough money to buy whatever I want, whenever I need it. So that was a very hard wish to beat, the $100 billion US wish. And don't think that $200 billion beats it, because $100 billion just means more money you can ever spend. So the fourth kid was really stuck to find a better wish than $100 billion. But she managed to find a much better wish. She said, if I had a wish, my wish would be for three wishes. That's a wish. And for the first of those three wishes, I'll have the computer shop. The second of my three wishes, I'll have $100 billion US. And for my third of my wishes, I'll have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. Beat that. And that's a hard wish to be, the infinity of wishes granted. For the last child, won the wishing game. The last child managed to think of a wish which was superior than an infinity of wishes granted. The last child said, if I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes ever again. So content I don't need any more wishes. And that won the wishing game. That is called enlightenment, nirvana. So content you don't need any more wishes. The end of craving. The fourth kid, the one who had infinitive wishes, that's called the freedom of desire. Well, you can get whatever you want whenever you want it. That's what most people aspire to, is happiness in life. That's where you work hard and save. Or you want to go into politics and get powerful. To get whatever you want whenever you want it. The freedom of desire. But that is not as powerful as the freedom from desire. So content you don't need wishes anymore. That's called nirvana. The one before, the freedom of desire, that's called being born as a heavenly being. Get whatever you want, whenever you want it. That's nowhere near as satisfying as being so content you don't need wishes anymore. That's nirvana. Beautiful explanation. So, there we go. Anyone can understand that? That's why it's so wonderful to meditate. And you get this taste of nirvana, taste of freedom. You're sitting there, you're so content, you don't need anything. You're not hungry, you don't want to go to watch the TV, you don't want to go to swimming, you're just so happy sitting here doing absolutely nothing. So content. There's no desires at all in your mind. It's so wonderful. How many times, I often ask this question, how many times in your life have you been sitting somewhere and realized there's no other place in the world I'd rather be than right here, right now? But if a genie came out of a bottle and gave you three wishes, you said, no, thank you. I'm so happy just being here. I have enough. I'm content. It's so wonderful, those experiences. Well, you don't want anything, you don't need anything. You're totally content, totally free. Hopefully you've had those experiences in your life. They're a taste of freedom. Freedom from desire. Just so happy to be here. So please, in the next couple of days, or even longer if you're staying here, don't go thinking about going home. Just be so happy to be here. Enjoy every moment of this retreat. You paid enough money for it, so squeeze every moment of joy and happiness out of this if you possibly can. Happy to be here, rather than always wanting to be somewhere else. It's amazing. Many times in your life, that's what your life is about. You're always going somewhere else. Never really being here. Because you're not content. Every now and again, just stop. Have a day of doing nothing. Get up in the morning. Yeah, you can roll up to meditation if you want. You don't have to. Just go down to the beach if you feel like going down. You don't have to. Have a beautiful day. And there's nothing to do. No goals, no schedules. Every moment just unfolds without any plans. Isn't that beautiful? You're just being here. Anyway, the Ajahn Brahm, is there such a thing as fate? Yes, you are all fated to come here on this retreat. And I will tell you your fate. You're all fated at the end of this retreat to become monks and nuns. Do you believe me? No. There's no such thing as fate. Because we're always creating the future every moment. It's not all written in the stars. I've looked at the stars with great telescopes. I haven't seen any writing on any of those stars. It's not written in the stars. And as for horoscopes, when I had a birthday many years ago, that somebody for my birthday present, they decided to do a proper horoscope to predict what my year would be. And so they paid some money for this guy to do a horoscope for you. And he read it out in front of all the monks. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, happy birthday to you today. This is your horoscope for the year." He said, "This particular year," he began, according to this expert astrologer, he said, "this year will be a very good year for romance." And he was wrong. I'm still a muck. That's a very funny way to say that. Everyone cracked up and treated me. There is no such thing as fate. The future is uncertain. It's unpredictable. No one knows. Isn't that a wonderful thing? You don't know what's going to happen next. Are our lives somewhat predestined? Mine isn't, so I don't know about yours. No, nothing is predestined. You take responsibility. It's all up to you what you want to do. Do you have any recommendations to deal with addiction issues? Yeah, if you're addicted, more in the mention to pornography, or you're addicted to watching movies or watching the TV or video games or alcohol or cigarettes or anything else which is bad for your health, it's mindfulness, this meditation which we teach here is a way to overcome it. Look, last about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was over in Kuala Lumpur raising funds for the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, and then during that visit, I was had an interview with this very, very rich guy who said that he had, I forget what the addiction was, but because he had a bad addiction, he was very, very wealthy. His family flew him all the way to the United States to see this fellow called John Kabat-Zinn, who was the fellow who invented or began mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is a huge thing in the United States, which and also over in Singapore and Malaysia, probably in Thailand too if you go to Bangkok. This is the breakthrough psychology technique of the last 10 years which cures all sorts of addictions and antisocial behavior, attention deficit disorder, depression, you name it, it cures it. And when he went to, because he was very rich, he got a personal session with John Kabat-Zinn, and then he went to some of the doctors in the Mayo Clinic, that's where all these film stars go to get cured from their addictions. And when he told me, he said, "These were all Buddhists. They were all teaching meditation." And afterwards I realized I spent all this money flying to the United States and having these appointments which you pay rock star and film star fees for, and I could have got it from someone like you for nothing. And that's really so true. All these rock stars and film stars, incredibly wealthy people, are so stupid. They can come to the Buddhist Fellowship on an afternoon and get it for free. But they pay a few thousand dollars a minute for it. Actually, I really am undervalued here. But anyhow, so it's all given out for free. But it actually shows you that this Buddhism is, especially the meditation practices, is the way to overcome addictions. So any of these people you see, like Madonna or something, going into this Mayo Clinic for addiction therapy, they actually learn what you learn here. Just learning how to let go, be kind, be peaceful, be mindful, and then you find addictions vanish. So you come to the experts. Very good value for money. Actually, I was giving this keynote address once. I was flown all the way from Australia to London to give a keynote address at a human resources conference, the biggest one in Europe they do every year. And they'd see me in Singapore when I did a session for human resources in Singapore some years ago. They had a big meeting there, and I was a talent spotted and flown to London for this. All expenses paid, nice hotel. And so I was about to give my talk, and the organizers, they said, there's someone at the gate trying to get in for free who says that you're his brother. And I said, yeah, that'd be my brother trying to get in for free. So I went with the organizer again. He said, oh, look, come on, I'll come all this way. I'm not taking any fees. At least you can let my brother in. And he was there with his daughter, my niece. And so they said, well, you're allowed to get one person in for free, but two is a bit much. And so I used my charm and said, oh, come on, be kind. And so I got them both in for free. And as soon as I got them in for free, I said, you cheapskates, can't you pay? You both got jobs. You really embarrassed me. But then my brother said, look, I'd be willing to pay, but you wouldn't believe how much they were asking. You know, just for 1 hour session, listening to me, I think it was something like £300 per person. Now I know my market value. And these people were paying that to listen to me. So, you know, you get it really cheap at the BA. Anyway, I'm curious to know, is there any significance that the rabbit next to your seat and the word it could try? Okay. This was actually probably in the year of the rabbit, that's all. Very, very simple. No significance at all whatsoever. Sometimes you must be so restless to spend all your time, instead of washing your breath, you're washing your stomach. Anyway, does any kind of sport include in the seven precepts? I'm not sure. Can I run or go to fitness for exercise? Well, this is when you do the seven precept retreat later on. It's all right to play sport as long as you play it with Buddhist principles. I saw a couple of the retreats are playing ping pong. That's the way I walked back to my room. If you play ping pong, table tennis, just next to the spa, you have to do it Buddhist principles. So when you hit the ball back, hit it nice and high so the other person can hit it back nice and easy. Don't smash it and make it difficult for them. You're supposed to be kind. So that's the Buddhist sport. So if you're having a race, then let the other person win. Because right? They get very disappointed when they lose. Because they know you win. And if there's a couple of Buddhists in the race, they know you win. No, no, I insist. You win. No. I'll be the last. No, I insist. I've got more method than you have. You win. No. That's real good Buddhist sport. That's why there are no Buddhists in the Olympic Games. They all lose on principle. Yeah, you can run for exercise and go on those exercise bikes, whatever you wish to do. That's not sport, that's just looking after your body. Swim. Well, what you can do, instead of swim, try doing walking meditation on water, and if that doesn't work, then swim. Yeah, you can do swimming meditation if you like. What is the meaning and purpose of life? If all of us were born and will eventually die and then reborn again, what is the meaning and purpose behind all of this? That's really easy. The meaning of life is to be kind. The meaning of life for you is to listen to Ajahn Brahm's jokes. I need you. I can't tell jokes to myself all day. So that's your purpose in life of the science. The life of my city jokes. It was that really, really bad Buddhist joke which I said the other day. It's about our cat died. The cat had 9 lives, but it got hit by a truck with 10 wheels.
That's a terrible bad boys joke.
Anyway, that's the purpose of life.
Dear Atkinson, well, this is really hard to read. I have found out that I have an issue with my mother. Somehow, no matter how hard I try to be closer to her, she always manages to push me away when I get too close. I feel she has hurt me too many times, and I feel emotionally damaged because of her. Although I'm now all grown up, I feel that for some reason, and I'm unsure, I still long for her approval. In her eyes, and she's expressed it, I'm a disappointment. When I feel I'm not, she has expectations which I know I want me to achieve, but I have not. I need time. I know I shouldn't let her control my happiness, but I'm powerless when it comes to my mother, someone so close to my heart. I can't seem to control my feelings when it comes to her. She makes me feel worthless. Please advise, thanking you always. You know, but that's what you probably feel that your mother thinks about you. You're worthless. But I've never yet met any mother who doesn't love her son or daughter to bits. Sometimes they don't express it very clearly. They want you to do so well in life, they forget the most important thing is not that you do well, that you're happy. So all you need to do is for your child, no matter how old they are, yeah, we want you to do well at school and in life, but even more important than that is you're happy. And you know, just like my father said to me, son, whatever you do in your life, however you turn out, wherever you go, please know the door of my heart will always be open to you. And that just meant so much. I had my father's unconditional love. And that's all I wanted. If I turned out to be a bank robber, still, he said, I will still love you. You're my son, that's enough. If I turned out to be a bad bank robber, he would still love me. And you know, it's so wonderful to get that unconditional love. So please, to your children, please, if you haven't done it yet, please do it. Do it every birthday until it really gets into them, to say to them that you're my son. You're my daughter. Yeah, I really want you to do well in life. You know, to get a good job, do well at university and school. Good Lord, even if you don't. Now, you're my kid. I'd always love you. So the door of my heart will always, forever be open to you. No matter what you do and how you turn out. So that your kids, they do feel loved. They are loved, but you've got to express it. You haven't expressed it yet. So please do that. Your kids on this retreat, please do it. And the same with your mum. You know, you have to open the door of your heart to your mum as well. But sometimes your mum or your dad, sometimes they try their best, but sometimes they're imperfect and say the wrong things. They try too hard. And they're not skilled enough in knowing how to express their love for their kids. Parents, they want to do the very best for their children. But sometimes in trying to do their best, they try too hard. And the kid hears that they're worthless. Which is one of the reasons why I tell people, look, if you are a failure in life, you're the greatest success. Remember the last time I was at the BF, I told the story of the boy who came bottom of my class. I was a school teacher, and this kid came 30th in a class of 30 kids at the school I taught him. And when I gave out the report cards, and I saw this guy open his report card and find out the bad news, he was bottom of the class. I saw him get so depressed. You know what happens when you get bad news? Your shoulders drop, your head goes down. You didn't need to be a mind reader to know he was thinking, how is he going to show this report to his parents that evening? His parents are going to go ballistic on him. Bottom of the class. And he was also very afraid of what his friends would say, the peer pressure. Dummy,
you know, you're short of a, you know, a few, whatever it is. You know, you haven't got enough brains. You know, you're no smart. You're a dummy. You're a bozo. You're a doofus. All these words we have for people who are stupid. And that's what he get from his friends. So I decided to go up to him and cheer him up and take him out of his depression. All the kids in my class knew I was a Buddhist, so I decided to teach him some Buddhism. I said to this boy, I said, there's something in Buddhism we call the Bodhisattva. And a Bodhisattva is highly respected and revered, even worshipped in Buddhism, as one of the most holy, supreme, wonderful beings. And a Bodhisattva is somebody who sacrifices their happiness so that no one else would have to suffer. I said, that's you this year. You've deliberately become bottom of the class on purpose so none of your friends have to face what you're going to face this evening from your parents. You're the Bodhisattva, and I'm going to recommend your name to the principal to get this year's Bodhisattva of the Year prize in my school. You're a hero. Not like your selfish friends, they just think of themselves. And it broke his depression, because he looked at me as if I was the craziest person he'd ever met in his life. And wondered what I was doing as his school teacher. But it broke him out of his depression. And I told him, I did tell him at the end, I said, in this school, please remember this, you're only allowed to take the Bodhisattva prize once. So please let one of your friends be Bodhisattva next year. Because I didn't want to cheer him up, even though he came bottom of the class. It was the class of Einsteins. There'd be one Einstein had to come bottom. It's a big deal. Don't worry about it. All I was saying is, kid, the door of your teacher's heart is open to you. Will always be open to you. Even if you come bottom of the class, you're still respected and loved and cared for. That's what was really important to me. But it's so important that people know that. So you say that to your parents. Your parents say that to your kids. You won't have, you know, this person or anybody thinking they're worthless. A lot of kids feel like that, you know, because they don't live up to their parents' expectations. The people they love the most, their parents, the ones they want to please the most, they just can't reach that goal. And that makes them feel failures when they only be 10 or 11 years of age. Don't do that to them. Just please encourage them, but please make sure that if you fail, you're still my kid and I love you to bits. You're a Bodhisattva. Why do we bow three times? Is it to represent the Buddha Dhamma Sangha? Or as you said, peace, virtue, etc. But why three? Everything's done in threes in Buddhism. We have the three refuges. We have the three bows. We have the three wise men. We have my favourite coffee, three in one. That's what I bring with me. Very easy. So no, we just do it in threes, because maybe the first time you're not so mindful, the second time your mindfulness is better, the third time you're really very mindful. Why we say three sadhus? It's all done in threes. Three is a good number. Basically I'm saying I don't know.
Three